In this show, we're joined by Andy Billings, Electronic Arts VP of Profitable Creativity and the co-founder of the EA University. Andy has a diverse and fascinating background and range of interests, but we're particularly excited about his experiences of leadership during EA's incredibly turbulent time, from a position of dominance in the console games era to near death and then successful transformation in the new world of free and online games. Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm good, John. How are you doing today?
I'm very excited because we have Andy Billings, a longtime friend and collaborator over the years, and you've done some work with him as well, I know. So I think this is going to be a very interesting show.
I've been excited about this one all week long. Andy and I have done a little bit of work together. Andy, so let me do the honors of telling folks a bit about you. Andy works with executives, managers, and teams to shape their future and transform how they do business through innovation, product development, and organization building. He holds a PhD in behavioral psychology and is currently the VP of Profitable Creativity at Electronic Arts, which is a very cool title, Andy. I once knew an accountant that got in a lot of trouble for profitable creativity, but I'm going to assume your title means something else entirely. Andy stresses the vital importance of leadership development as a force for transformational change and helps leaders learn to overcome impossible challenges. Participants in Andy's learning and development initiatives have played a major role in the company's digital transformation and financial turnaround, which we will be talking about today. In addition to his work with today's leaders, Andy is also working with the day after tomorrow's leaders. He is a business advisor to startup organizations and mentors social purpose startup leaders at Singularity University. Serves as a board member of a 100-plus-year-old privately held family-owned consumer retail business and is a board member and past chair of the California Strategic HR Partnership. Andy has also served in the innovation advisory boards of two Fortune 500 companies and currently serves on the board of Interactive Professionals Association. Wow, that is an impressive CV. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Well, okay, so joking aside on the comment I made about the title, you do have a very interesting job title. Where did that come from? Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So there was a time in Electronic Arts when we were probably creative, but we weren't very profitable. And we needed to make a turnaround and a transformation in the company. And so we really started to put an emphasis on the collaboration between the creatives and the, you know, we at the time we called them the suits, the business people. And so became focused on how do we help integrate, fuse, connect the creative forces in the company with the business forces in the company. And so that got to the idea of, you know, we can be creative and we can be profitable at the same time. And that those things, sure, naturally sometimes have some tensions between each other, but it's critical for our survival to get them to connect. And so, you know, we began working on projects and initiatives that would help us more predictably and more reliably create games, which were both fun and critically well-received and profitable at the same time. So that's how the name came to be. Not to be confused with creative profitability, where your accountant was doing something. This is all about
wasn't my accountant.
Yeah, all about connecting creativity for a successful business.
So, Andy, welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you here. I always enjoy our time together. Some years ago, we talked about EA's near extinction and the subsequent deep transformation that the organization went through and the need for leaders to live in the future. Can you kind of walk us through that story and pick out some of the most important things that you learned, both as yourself as a leader, but also that the organization learned?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's about around 2006 and company was really in a happy place. You know, I mean, the sun was out, the birds were singing, we were doing fantastically. We're profitable, we're just making one hit after the other. And then something changed and we were a little slow to recognize those changes. And so within 2 years later, we had gone to, you know, a massive losing situation where, you know, for every billion we, you know, for every 4 billion we made, we lost a billion. So we were losing, you know, at a unsustainably negative rate. So what we came to realize is there were a couple of things that were probably hard to prepare for. One was just a massive global recession. And we were waiting for a new console to come out, the game consoles come out from what we call first parties. Then when those consoles are announced, players wait and don't buy software because they knew the new consoles were going to come out. But the thing that we really missed and underemphasized was how quickly the world was going to go to the internet and how quickly the world was also going to go to a business model change around playing games for free, which to a game like Electronic Arts, which proudly made wonderful games and sold them for 60 euros, you know, the idea of, well, you get to play that game for free was, you know, quite a rude awakening. And so, you know, that led us to those really dark days in 2008. We were really in tough shape and, you know, led us to realize we were going to need to make a massive transformation from being a retail company, selling our games at stores and selling, and our customers really being retailers, to going direct digitally to players. So we've gone from 95% retail, 5% online, to today we're about 85-90% digital and the rest retail. So quite a transformation. We lost a CEO in that process. We went through some, you know, really difficult changes. But let me just pause there and just see if there's some areas you might want to talk about specifically in that process.
Well, I'm always very interested in, you know, how the leaders in confronted that, because many organizations in that situation, you know, similar kind of thing hit Blockbuster. They don't reimagine the business. They don't spend enough time, as you put it, living in the future to be able to figure out what to do. So the two things I suppose I'm really interested in is what did the leaders need to do to shift their mindset? You know, the way they saw the world and the way that they reacted to it. And what did they do differently as a result of that, that got you on the path to a new future?
Yeah, you know, there's always that early challenging part of the process where you're not quite sure if those disruptions and those changes are going to be long lasting. And so you don't want to completely leave behind that which has made you so successful to take on something that's uncertain. And so we went through a number of years where we were really kind of trying to live on both sides of the equation and have a retail business and have a digital business. And we experimented with different organizational structures where we could have a retail business and a digital business. And we, you know, ultimately came to see that that digital business was going to be the stronger one and over time have to make a, you know, really a large budget financial investment in that. In that new business. So that's a change that the leaders went through. I think another really interesting change was that for a while, we thought that people who understood digital were kind of a special breed of people and had some kind of special skills and were somehow new and unique. And so we went on a search for those people. Of course, everyone else in the world wanted to go find the same people. And so one of the things interesting today that we find is that the people that are very successful in our digital business have all come out of our more classic retail model. And so over time, they were able to evolve and to change themselves to be successful in a completely new world. So that was a big change. And we've just recently brought a person into the company that's going to lead our mobile and digital business. And that person has a, you know, if you will, kind of the classic old industry background and training and, you know, is going to do very well in the new world. So I think part of the mindset is, you know, leaders and people can change. They can skill up. They can learn new business models and new ways of working, new ways of interacting with players and, you know, make that transition themselves. It just takes a while.
What was the biggest thing that you were fighting, in the mindset of leaders? What do you think held people back in doing that faster or more, you know, more deeply?
I think that we're classically focused on the customers that made us successful, and those were retailers. And so, yes, while we paid a lot of attention to players, we didn't really have the deep, direct connection with players that we do today. And so a really big change for us was to have a much deeper awareness of the need to understand your customer, understand the player, and to pull them into the game development process, the product development process in our organization. So for instance, 15 years ago, we might have a couple of players talk to us about the thinking about a new game. Today, even as we're thinking about a new game, we have players playing the concepts. We have players in increasing numbers playing the game as it continues to evolve. We're continually getting feedback from those players. We're doing that digitally, but we're also sometimes bringing in, you know, some of our most knowledgeable, influential gamers, players, and they're actually helping us shape the design of the product as well. So it's both the design and the tuning of a game. And so a major game today that, you know, maybe takes 3 to 5 years to develop, we'll literally have 10 or 15,000 players that have played that game before it's even ready to kind of go into its test market launch. So for us, that's really been a rethink who your customer really is and rethink how close you can get to that customer and the practices by which you engage that community.
Andy, you have such a vast experience with all different types of leaders, and the EA transformation story is such an interesting one. There's this tension that I talk to leaders about quite often, right? And it's a reality that I think is difficult to navigate, and I'd love to get your perspective on it. And that is, how do leaders find the balance, or anybody actually, find the balance between sustaining the sort of short-term performance that's required for today while also creating long-term value for tomorrow? So, I mean, oftentimes the future is traded off for the immediate because of the internal and external pressures. What, in your opinion, has to happen for people to be able to hold those tensions and those opposites where they can create the value today but also achieve the value tomorrow?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Kind of really gets at one of our most central challenges. We call that whole area scaling up. So as our company gets bigger and as it gets more complex and the world gets more complex, leaders have to move from what they're currently doing to what they need to be doing in the future. We call that scaling up. And you know, when the company's growing quickly and the world's changing quickly, that's a pretty abrupt scale up change. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a step change rather than an incremental change. I think part of what we think is important is actually just to name the issue. So we call it scaling up, and we've been working on actually operationalizing success at that, which we think is, Scott, as you said, doing them both. So it's not, I'll spend time in the future, or I'll spend time on our current operations. It's, you have to put the word in there between those things and put that in big capitals and say, I need to have high current performance and I must be investing time in the future. And, you know, begin to kind of grapple with how do I get both of those things balanced. We've also roughly tried to operationalize the future and the current as a 12-month time horizon. I suppose other organizations might say, well, gee, strategic really should be 3 to 5 years. For us, it's a year. So we say, you know, when leaders are working more than 12 months out, you know, we're calling that strategic. And if it's less, we call that operational. And we've actually been experimenting a little bit with actually asking people to measure that. And we've done some surveys and asked people to kind of look at their time and to, you know, to try and quantify what's the current balance, what would they like that balance to be, and that delta between the way they are today and what they would like it to be in the future sometimes gives us some clues as to where they would start to change their leadership practices and the way the team would operate so that you would actually be able to have the time. You know, as you can imagine, almost always it's people want to put more time into the future than they currently are. And so where are we going to find the time to do that without loss of our current high performance?
What's the typical balance for that population, your leadership population, between today and tomorrow?
I'm not sure that we would actually say we've reached success in an absolutely accurate measure of time. I think we've been able to measure how big a change it is. But I would imagine it's, you know, for senior executives, it's 70% current operations, as much as 30% in the future. You know, in really difficult times, though, it'll shift back to, you know, 80, 85% of your time is in the present. what would the ideal be? I think people would say, I'd like to, you know, at a senior level, spend about 50-50. But I'd say that's a stretch for us because, you know, it's a fast changing world. And so, you know, you often have to be changing your plans that were still within the 12-month time frame. Yeah, but interesting question. You know, I think it's really more the delta and how are we going to make the shift and how are we going to start to change our leadership practices and our business systems so that we can get that time balance right and do that scale up.
And I think something you said there that's just so important is you said, you know, and the word and in capitals, right? So it sounds like less about this concept of them being competing priorities, but it's really the merging of those two things is the current reality. We have to have the mindset that says, I do both of these things and I do them in the appropriate measure that's required for the situation that I'm in. Is that fair?
That's fair. You know, it's a really difficult balancing act. Some organizations, as we all know, solve that by naming a group to be responsible for more than 12 months out for the strategic group. And they'll name other groups to be responsible for the current performance. And we've done a little bit of that at Electronic Arts. We have a group that, we have a strategy group, but we actually have a kind of a futures and a strategic growth group that concentrates out into the future. But boy, it's really interesting. It's not long before pretty soon those strategic initiatives have current operational requirements. And even those leaders start to have their time pulled into the current. So I think it kind of goes back to, we think in the long term, a leader is going to be able to do both effectively. So that and is going to operate and people are going to, you know, while their time balance might change depending on their role, everyone will have to spend some time in the future.
So speaking of the future, a couple years back, you did a great piece of work with my team that you called Future Wheels. And it was a model that was tremendously helpful in us doing a great piece of strategic planning. And what I found particularly brilliant is its simplicity. I always think the best models are just really simple. I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about Future Wheels and how you use them to unlock strategic thinking and doing really, you know, thoughtful strategic planning.
Yeah, thank you. Future Wheels, sometimes people also call it disruption mapping or innovation mapping. It's actually a tool out of the Futurist toolkit. And we find that some of those tools of Futurist, which help you kind of imagine the future, you know, turn out to be pretty useful for us. So if you visually kind of imagine a group of people working at the, you know, on a poster or a whiteboard or a piece of paper, you had a central circle. And in that circle, you put an innovation or change. And then radiating out from it, you put other circles. And those circles are the consequences of that change. And then you put another row of circles out beyond, even further out. And those are the second order consequences of those changes. And then way out beyond are the third order. So you're looking at first order consequences, second and third. But maybe an example maybe would help us a little bit. So if you talked about self-driving car technology, let's put that in the central circle. And we might start to think about, well, what would be one of the consequences of that? Well, here in California, that means that you can now probably get in a self-driving car from San Francisco to LA. You could either sleep, or who knows, maybe you could play games, or the different self-driving vehicles could have different themes. So that's a first order consequence. Then the third order consequence might be, you know, rather than getting on Southwest Airlines, I might just take a self-driving car from San Francisco to LA. And so now what we've got is airlines competing with self-driving cars. And so for someone like Electronic Arts, we might think about how would you put gaming in there, or what's involved in there. But the first order consequences we can see pretty well. The second and third order consequences are a little bit harder to imagine. And so the wheel mapping allows kind of the brain to see second and third order consequences, visualize them, and anticipate what they mean. And so the future wheel just means those are the future consequences that are radiating from that central innovation or disruption.
Which gets people deliberately focused out while thinking about today at the same time, right? It's kind of a good exercise in that now and then thinking we've been talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Then I think the other thing that you do in those exercises is you look at those wheel, you know, you look at those little wheels that are way outside the second and third order consequences. And from them, you kind of go, what does that tell us about the present? What insights should we be drawing from that? What are those possibilities? And out of that, what action should we be taking? So, you know, should a game company begin to form partnerships with self-driving vehicles so that we can have gaming experiences inside those vehicles? Well, you wouldn't necessarily have thought when you sat down and go, like, who could we partner with as a gaming company? You wouldn't necessarily think, oh, Ford, GM, right. You know, these other companies that are forming self-driving car divisions. So that's an example of helping anticipate opportunities that you wouldn't necessarily otherwise face. And for a company like Southwest Airlines, it's an opportunity for them to anticipate, hey, this self-driving technology could have a much bigger impact on us than we might otherwise have thought.
Right.
So essentially, it's helping you to make sense of those kind of weak signals from the future, play back, and draw them together in terms of, you know, actionable insights for the organization.
Sean, that's exactly it. Yes. Yep. It's that process of looking at the future, drawing some insights, coming up with a couple of actions in the near term. Again, you can't do that if you don't have any cycles to put into time for the future.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there any, you know, when you've done these kind of sessions, is there any kind of moments you can recall where, you know, there has been this kind of breakthrough? You don't necessarily need to reveal anything, you know, secret here, but, you know, where literally it has kind of opened up people's minds to a completely different avenue for the business.
What it's helped us open up is the fact that the partners we have today, the friends in the ecosystem, if you want to kind of think about it that way, are going to become our competitors in the future. And so while we have very strong partnerships with them and, you know, a big part of our business is interdependent, at some point we may be competitors. So we're now competitors with Apple, Google, Amazon, which are also our partners, you know, in other dimensions of the business. And so it helps you anticipate some of the complexities that you're going to run into before they immediately show up on your doorstep. Because I think all of this is designed to help you anticipate with enough time to be prepared. Otherwise, you look like a company like Electronic Arts in 2006 that didn't anticipate all these things. And then you're really in a survival mode all of a sudden. All that said, we still think we're fortunate to be alive. And we now maybe have a little more deeply ingrained kind of a sense that, you know, the next massive disruptions around the corner, and you know, we hope we can anticipate it and we hope we can survive, but we, you know, I think we are more humble, you know, and realize, you know, not every organization can survive every disruption.
So on that note, I mean, I'd really love to understand the kind of ideas and the challenges facing you. I mean, one of them here is obviously you've got waves upon waves of disruption. It sounds like, you know, this is an organization that's really coming to terms with the concept of both and in lots of different ways. You know,
right.
Competitors are right. are our partners, and the future and the present are, you know, need to be held together. What else you know is really challenging your leadership at the moment? What are the greatest challenges facing you in the next 2 to 3 years?
Yeah, there are a lot of them, but you know, maybe we can just talk about a couple of them. One of them is, where do you get this time to work on the future? Where do you get the time to anticipate and to manage disruption, especially if you need high current performance? We think that one of the solutions is to work differently with your team. And we've been calling that team of leaders, which means that you're asking your team to pick up leadership functions that the team leader once held. So let's just take this, just a really, really simple example of that. You know, maybe I'm responsible for a team and I'm, you know, I have my weekly staff meeting, you know, kind of that classic event, and I pull my team very, you know, very effectively. I get issues. We look at our metrics. We have a pretty well organized thing, but it still takes my time to get ready for that. And then when it comes time, I host it. Who knows? You know, maybe I take up most of the speaking time and kind of make sure that the team is interacting and having a good conversation. And in general, I'm providing the momentum and responsibility for that. What if that went to a member of the team, or that that responsibility rotated? Okay, that's one of the, you know, that's a simple one. But all of a sudden, something that maybe took, you know, so say I spent 2 or 3 hours of my week on getting ready and running that and following up, that now went to the team. That frees up time for me. So it's a mindset around things that you once thought needed to be done by the team leader. Can they be done by the team? Not only just as a, you know, I'm going to release them or delegate them, perhaps they can actually be done better. And that that will allow the team leader to work cross-functionally or off into the future, you know, which then also ultimately going to make that team more successful as well. So that's a concept we're working with, and we've kind of been trying to map stages of moving towards a more fully a team of leaders approach. But, you know, that's a really big change because some members of a team don't want to take on those responsibilities. You know, maybe it's now like, what should we work on? How should we work on it? How do we deal with our partners inside a complex organization? Some of those topics have conflict involved with them. So, you know, team members need to be willing and prepared to take those on, and they need to begin to work with their team member, their peers on it. To do that, you need things like trust and collaboration and, you know, effective work processes. So, yikes, all of a sudden, people who kind of worked a little bit more in a hub and spoke process with their manager are now really an interdependent, in many ways, a self-led team. You know, we're kind of going back and getting that classic idea of teams which are self-led and trying to update it and bring it in, into the current, and use that as a way for the team to allow the team leader to focus into the future.
How has COVID and the forced lockdown impacted that, the teaming, and what have you learned about ways of working now that, you know, since being remote for all these months?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, certainly, you know, we were maybe a 5% work from home company before becoming 100% work from home company. I think one of the things that we're, you know, team leaders are seeing is that team members that have a sense of autonomy, have a sense of broad perspective about what's going on in the team and how their team fits more broadly within the company, they're the ones who know what to work on, how to get work done, who they should collaborate with, and, you know, have that capacity to be more self-led, more self-directing. And so I think it's maybe bringing forward this idea of team of leaders, because the people are more, they're more autonomous. They're setting more of their own direction. They're deciding how to run their day, who to have meetings with. You know, and most of what you'd call productivity is, it's very hard to see directly. So you really have much more of an objectives, results-oriented kind of approach to teamwork. So those are some of the things that we're, you know, kind of accelerating that change to more responsibility moving into the team.
Andy, what you know, I know you're a voracious studier of the human condition and leadership. What's firing you up in terms of new thinking or ideas on leadership at the moment? And I'm sure you've been doing some reading in lockdown as well.
I think we've been thinking a lot about decision making. So if you think about time, leadership time, as the currency of scale up, decision making, you could imagine, is the way you spend that currency. Because time, you know, decisions are kind of the key to preparing for the future. They're all about choices. And how effective you are in decision making affects both your success in the future, but it has a huge impact on your time. So especially as your organizations get a little bit larger, I mean, even by the time you reach 50 people, all of a sudden decisions, you know, one, they're getting distributed, and two, how they're getting made is getting more complex. And so issues of who's going to make the decision, and do we all know how that's going to work? What work process does it take to make a decision? You know, those things maybe sound simple, but in today's world, decision-making is so complex. You have people inside, outside, lateral, peers, research, metrics. So that decision-making process can get really stretched out in time. And then if that happens, then you can sometimes be too late to the future. So if we, you know, if we take 2 years to make a decision on investing in a new business model or a new game, that potentially puts us out of position to be competitive 2 to 5 years into the future. So we're thinking, if we can get better at decision making, know which ones maybe can be made shorter in time, which ones maybe can go to team of leaders, we're working at this whole issue around organizational capacity and productivity, again, as kind of one of the ways that you can find the time and the cycles to prepare for the future. I mean, I always kind of think about myself, and I think about a team and an organization as being really pretty much 100% optimized to succeed in the present. And so if you want to succeed in the future, you're going to have to destabilize in some ways and reconfigure to operate, you know, in a new format. And so, you know, again, kind of the way you make decisions, who makes them, how you make them, how long they take to make really becomes a critical, but maybe even unseen dimension of organizational effectiveness. So we've been trying to actually have conversations around who's making this decision. Is there going to be a leader that tells us? Are we going to have a consensus? Get that clear? What information do we need to gather? How does it need to be made? Who's going to be involved in making the final decision? And is there a time box in which this decision becomes much more valuable to us if we can make it in a shorter amount of time? So we've just been trying to get more explicit about decisions. So that's something that we're, you know, pretty excited about these days.
That's really interesting. And it makes me wonder about something Jeff Bezos says around, you know, as an organization gets bigger, the decisions appear to people to become more and more irreversible. You know, once I've made the decision, that's it. You know, we have to go for it. And he's saying, no, that's not true. You know, you have to see many, many more decisions as reversible. You know, if you get data immediately telling you you're wrong, then, you know, change, pivot, go back, do it again. How open is, you know, the leadership in your organization to kind of rewriting the decisions and making their minds up again and accepting they might not be right?
Yeah, that's a good question. So many of those decisions have such a massive investment of money and time and consume market space or market opportunity. So, I mean, for instance, in our games, a new intellectual property, which is what we call a new game, a new creative idea, takes a minimum of 3 years and more often 5 to 7 years to conceptualize, refine, begin to execute, because it's got all kinds of innovations, right? So it's going to be successful in the marketplace, needs to be new and fresh and creative and innovative. And yet you have to be thinking 3 to 5 years into the future. So some things we're very, very careful about. And so we work carefully on decisions about which products to invest in and which ones to carry forward. So those take time. Things around people's assignments, their time, projects, things of that sort, we're trying to, you know, make decisions about more quickly. So maybe to your point, we're trying to differentiate decisions which are really big stakes and would be very expensive if we make the wrong decision, and those for which the, you know, the outcomes are, you know, less critical. And, you know, again, kind of going back to the theme of our call, if you can look into the future and see what the possibilities are and place a number of experiments, you can do things pretty quickly at low risk and low cost. If you wait too long in that process, then you got to really make the big, heavy, scary bets. And that's hard for any leader.
So maybe we can take a slight change of direction and kind of come back to you personally, because you have such an impressive CV. As someone who works with, you know, all different types of leaders, I'm sure you're constantly pivoting and adjusting your own approach to things, depending on what individual or team that you're working with, because, you know, everyone has different learning styles and different approaches to their leadership. So I'm curious, in particular, how you continue to invest in and grow yourself. What have you learned about the way that you learn, and what have you learned maybe even in this, you know, these last several months, personally, and how you approach your work?
Yeah, interesting. Well, that gets me reflecting.
that's the point. That's what we like to do here.
One thing that always comes to my mind about the way I learn is I always need to have a use case in mind, you know, which is a term you hear a lot around an engineering and software company, like the use case. Well, how is this going to be applied? So I find if I read or I listen to podcasts, if I can think of a use case, here's a team or a leader or a situation that I can apply that, then I'm able to kind of get a hold of that those concepts and make them my own in a way that I can apply them. And if I work without it use case, they become just really interesting, kind of, you know, you're curious, but I'm not sure what I would do with that. So I try and find a use case to apply to everything I'm kind of thinking about. Doesn't mean that's the only thing that I'm going to apply it to, but that really helps me make it practical. And, you know, I think one of the things I've learned is that things which are practical and applied are with the things that are most interesting to me, as opposed to the things which are, you know, more purely conceptual. Because the other thing I just constantly remind myself to do is, because just like everyone, you know, lots of calls all day, different leaders, different size teams, organizations. I just try and remind myself to spend time just listening in the beginning and trying to be empathic to their point of view, their perspective, their challenges, and not lead with my ideas and not lead with my concepts and keep them a little more in the background and, you know, apply them if they work. And so in that way, I guess I try and be more issues driven or more leader centric as a way of kind of picking up with a leader and kind of getting in their sync rather than pushing them into a framework or a way of working or an existing process.
Sounds like you developed that from experience. What's happened in your past when you maybe just jumped right in with telling before you were sitting back and really listening?
Yeah. No, those things make me smile because I go like, oh, I think if you get very excited about an idea or a framework or a tool or a process or a meeting that you're organizing and you have very strong passion and enthusiasm for them, you kind of just bring that into the conversation and you want to lead with it. You want people to adopt it, go with it and apply it and be as excited and as enthusiastic as you are. And a lot of times there are other things on their mind or they have different ways of seeing things and you kind of just lose that opportunity to engage them because you've kind of pushed something towards them rather than ask them questions or, you know, try and more carefully find ways to modify it. And also sometimes just being prepared to say, you know, that person's idea or approach is just the better one for them and the situation, let's just go with that. And so that's kind of a process of becoming a little less emotionally attached to your own exciting, passionate ideas, you know, which you're, you know, convinced will save the world, but you know, you just have to kind of be, I think, a little more humble about it, a little more patient.
So, Andy, we want to thank you firstly for being, you know, a great guest, a great sport.
Yes.
For your honesty, for your insights, and your time, because we know how precious that is. And you know, at some point, we'd love to have you back when our show is established and you've listened to some of the other things, because I'm sure you'll be interested in those. So, Scott, maybe I hand over to you to bring us out.
Yeah. Thank you, Andy, for the time.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the call. And it's been good.
Thanks again. And to our listeners, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?